Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
He may have kept protesting his innocence,
but I'm not going to apologize for something I haven't done. And I draw the line at touching someone in a private area, a female in their private area, without their permission.
But that powerful Florida lawmaker has now decided to resign that job. Also this week, as more sexual harassment allegations keep surfacing in the public and private sectors, does the Florida agency charged with investigating those reports have what it needs to do the job?
Resources are important for us, and we try to work with the governor's office and the legislature to make sure we have what we need in order to meet the needs of the state.
We'll also get an update on the state's growing drug crisis and the strain it's putting on responders, as well as what one Florida university did to help a student in crisis. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. A powerful Florida senator, who was also vying to be the GOP candidate for governor, has been toppled over allegations of public corruption and sexual harassment. Lynn Hatter has the latest.
Two investigations substantiated allegations that State Senator Jack Latvala groped women and made sexually aggressive comments toward them. There's also evidence he offered to trade sexual favors for votes, which the special master's report notes could amount to public corruption, a criminal charge. The state Senate has handed over its findings, and Florida Department of Law Enforcement spokeswoman Gretel Plessinger says her office has the capacity to investigate the matter further.
We do have a unit called Executive Investigations, and in the past they have investigated government officials and
In his resignation letter, Latvala criticizes investigators for taking the word of accusers over his own, and he says he's been steadfast in promoting women professionally. In a November interview with Bay News 9's Political Connections show, Latvala fiercely maintained he has done nothing wrong.
You know, I have apologized for bringing the headlines to my family, even though I don't think I did anything wrong. I have apologized if I've let my mouth overload my good sense and something that I've said to people.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to apologize for something I haven't done. And I draw the line at touching someone in a private area, a female in their private area, without their permission.
So,
I've never done it, never will.
Attorney Stephen Andrews says Latvala chose to resign not because of guilt, but because the investigations were becoming a distraction to the legislature.
He realized that if we continued to challenge this, it would have been disruptive to the business of the Senate, disruptive to the state of Florida, and would have interfered with the job that the Senate would do in the upcoming session.
Throughout the investigations, Latvala has faced increasing calls to step aside. House Speaker Richard Corcoran was among the first to say Latvala should go, and he predicted earlier in the month in an interview with C-SPAN's Washington Journal that the senator could end up being forced out.
And honestly, it looks at this point that they're heading towards expulsion, and if he's expelled, he'll be one of the first sitting members in the legislature expelled in who knows how long, decades.
And Governor Rick Scott suggested previously that if allegations against the senator were true,
you know, he needs to resign.
Wednesday, Scott, along with Attorney General Pam Bondi, formally called for Latvala's resignation, making him the third state senator to step down this year. Frank Artiles of Miami left in May after making racist statements to two African-American lawmakers and disparaging Senate President Joe Negron. Democrat Jeff Clemons resigned in November after Politico Florida reported he had an affair with a lobbyist, and Politico Florida was also the first to report the allegations against Latvala. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The scene is a meeting room in the main branch of the Leon County Public Library, a few blocks from the state capitol. About a dozen personnel managers from various public and private sector organizations are seated around a long conference table, and Sharon Ofwani is giving them the legal definition of the term sexual harassment.
Sexual harassment is unwelcome sexual advances or requests for sexual favors. It can be verbal, it can be physical. It's what you say and it's what you do.
The lunch hour seminar covered such topics as making sure every organization has a written policy prohibiting workplace sexual harassment, and that the policy is clearly communicated to every employee. Recent highly publicized cases have shown a national spotlight on the issue of sexual harassment, particularly the on-the-job variety. But even though the details of many cases might seem complex, Ofwani, who was the City of Tallahassee's Equal Opportunity Director for more than three decades, thinks the basic issue is simple.
It's human decency and dignity and integrity and character and all those things that this issue is not a Republican, Democrat, left-right. It's a right-wrong. This is a right-wrong issue.
But simply knowing what's right and what's wrong isn't enough. There also have to be mechanisms in place for reporting wrongdoing. One such mechanism is the Florida Commission on Human Relations, where Michelle Wilson is the executive director.
We don't victimize a respondent, and we don't rally for the complaining party, but what we will do is get to the bottom of what a complaining party believes sexual harassment or any type of discrimination that they believe they've been victim to.
The whole purpose, says Wilson, is to conduct an impartial, evidence-based probe into the complaint.
We will do a fact-finding, and so it's so important for complaining parties to have documentation because we are going to allow the responding party the ability to respond to the complaint and look at both sides of the issue.
But with all the attention now being focused on the matter of sexual harassment, Wilson notes the number of inquiries and complaints on the topic is on the uptick.
I will tell you that we've started tracking it just to make sure, because I anticipated people asking me the uptick question. And we have received a lot of calls from the media wanting statistics. We have received calls from individuals wanting to know more about it to determine whether or not they're going to file. And we have received some additional cases as of late.
But media inquiries are one thing. Wilson notes if there's a sudden surge in the number of actual complaints requiring investigation, her staff could be stretched beyond their ability to respond as required by law.
An uptick in this area would certainly put an additional burden on them, considering the fact that the statute says we have 180 days to complete the investigations. And we want to make sure we can do a thorough investigation. So resources are important for us, and we try to work with the governor's office and the legislature to make sure we have what we need in order to meet the needs of the state.
And in a year when state budgets are already looking really tight to begin with, those investigative resources may be very tough to come by, particularly from a legislature that's been dealing with some high-profile sexual harassment cases of its own. Still to come on Capitol Report, some of the people best equipped to help turn around the addicted may not be able to because of what they did when they were addicted too.
Whatever criminal background they have, it's always related to their illness.
As Florida's prison system continues to deal with a problematic contraband issue, should they be looking for a technological solution?
Simple, no-cost stuff like plow lines, where we can detect an individual that has walked up to an exterior fence in the prison system and know that someone was there, because a lot of this stuff comes over the fence.
Republican state lawmakers are again trying to downsize the state's food stamp program as the economy continues to recover, and the measure is winning over some surprising supporters.
Unlike last year, I'm actually here to support Representative White's legislation. I appreciate you're not including the areas that we were most concerned with last year.
And state wildlife officials say in order to help people care about conservation, they need to help them connect to the outdoors. Opioid abuse may grab the headlines, but drug-related deaths overall are on the rise. And when it comes to helping people kick their addiction, Nick Evans reports one lawmaker believes Florida is rejecting some of the best people for the job.
Florida saw 2,126 more drug-related deaths in 2016 than it did in the prior year, according to the Florida Medical Examiner's annual report. That represents a 22% increase year over year.
There's a crisis in our state. And you all have heard me talk about this until I'm blue in the face. There's a crisis in our nation.
This is Miami Republican Rene Garcia. Within the Senate, he's one of the most consistent and forceful advocates on substance abuse and mental health policy. In 2016, he helped pass Senate Bill 12, a measure streamlining those services by encouraging a no-wrong-door approach. This session, he's trying to recruit more peer specialists.
There's no better advocate than a peer specialist. And there's no better person to help that individual get through that darkness than the peer specialist.
Put simply, peer specialists are men and women who have dealt with addiction or another mental illness, gone through recovery, and now want to help others. Gino Scano says there's just one problem.
We had a young fellow came in for a job as a peer specialist. I've known him for 21, 22 years. He's been sober for 20. He's an icon in the recovery community. He has a 21-year-old possession charge, and he was disqualified.
Scano is a recovery coach with Centerstone in Bradenton, Florida.
I've been in recovery for 27 years. I was a heroin addict for 24 years, an alcoholic most of my life. I'm a disabled vet. I have PTSD, and I'm not a throwaway.
He and others in the field say these experiences aren't deficiencies. They're bona fides. But ironically, the resume that makes someone a good mentor often bars them from participating.
They get certified, and then we see that they go through the level 2 background screening and then get stopped for the very thing that the very lived experience that made them become a peer specialist.
This is Cameron Wood, executive director of the Peer Support Coalition of Florida. Under current law, felony drug possession would be enough to disqualify a person from being a peer specialist. So, Garcia's plan would carve out a range of low-level crimes from the screening process to make it easier for peer specialists to gain employment in the field.
And these are individuals that have whatever criminal background they have, it's always related to their illness. It makes no sense. They just cannot practice and that cannot be those peer specialists. So that's why we have to try to reduce some of those barriers so they can easily go through the process.
Garcia's proposal passed its first committee unanimously, but it's a panel he chairs. The measure has to pass 2 more committees, neither of which Garcia sits on, before hitting the Senate floor. The House could present another challenge. So far, there's no companion measure in the lower chamber. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Fighting contraband has been an ongoing issue within the state's prison system. As Sasha Cordner reports, Florida's prison chief is exploring some innovative ideas to address the issue.
For the 2018 legislative session, Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Julie Jones is asking for $2 million to help address the prison system's contraband problem,
which includes increased technology to intercept dangerous contraband from entering the department's secure facilities, and additional contract staffing to gather and analyze security threat group intelligence. Security threat group means gangs.
In April of this year, Jones' agency created the Office of Intelligence. Among its jobs is to aid the effort to crack down on contraband throughout the state. The $2 million, she says, will also support that.
Combating contraband is an ongoing challenge, and this investment builds on the positive progress of the Office of Intelligence. And as an example, cell phones, synthetic drugs, and weapons are a growing problem that affect very directly the security of our facilities.
Jones spoke earlier this month before a Senate Budget Committee that looks at criminal justice issues. Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley wondered if Jones should be looking into a techie solution.
In this area of intelligence investment to minimize this kind of disruption of the system, one of the big concerns I have is the proliferation and struggle to control contraband, particularly like cell phones, where they can be empowered to organize and do things that they shouldn't be doing. And is it, what's the pros and cons of a technology that will scramble those messages so that there's no benefit to having a cell phone?
And Jones replied the prisons are already doing a few things in that area. Right now, there is a pilot underway at Wakulla Correctional Institution in the Panhandle and Okeechobee Correctional Institution in South Florida. It's provided by the prison's phone company at no cost to the corrections agency.
The MASS system sets up an umbrella over dorms. We try not to umbrella the entire prison so we don't bleed out and affect the 911, but this masks the ability for a cell phone to be used. and only by exception. So the warden's phone is an exception and would work.
There are also cell phone detectors that inmates have to walk by.
So if they did slip out of the dorm trying to come and go and to use it in some place that's outside the umbrella, that we can capture them. We've done a lot this year, simple, no-cost stuff like plow lines, where we can detect an individual that has walked up to an exterior fence in the prison system and know that someone was there to because a lot of this stuff comes over the fence.
And Joan says there's also technology in her legislative funding requests, not just for inmates, but correctional staff as well.
More x-ray machines and increases our ability to look not like a TSA-type machine, but inside body cavities in order to look for contraband that has been placed there to try to come into them. And we're also increasing searches for our own staff.
Prison guards smuggling contraband into Florida's prisons has been an ongoing issue. In fact, in recent months, several correctional officers in North Florida were fired and arrested for smuggling contraband, some in their body cavities. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Florida lawmakers are once again trying to reform the state's food stamp program, which has more than doubled since the recession. But unlike in previous years, the Republican-led effort could be making some inroads with Democrats. Kate Payne reports.
During the Great Recession, Florida expanded who could qualify for SNAP or food stamps as unemployment passed 11%. The number of recipients has more than doubled since 2008 to 3.2 million people. 1.3 million are children. Now that unemployment is back down to 4.1%, Republican Representative Gail Harrell thinks SNAP enrollment should drop too.
We've moved out of the recession and people have been able to get jobs, and we see the job rate increasing. We do not see the reduction, the commensurate reduction in people receiving SNAP.
Representative Frank White, a Pensacola Republican, is once again trying to change that.
This bill, HB 693, does two things. First, it aligns that food stamp program called SNAP, aligns the food stamp program to our improved economy by imposing an asset limit of $5,000, and that's only certain assets actually count towards that, an asset limit of $5,000 and requires a system for DCF to verify those assets.
There are some exceptions to that asset limit, which is higher than the federal cutoff.
Also, again, it only looks at countable assets. So assets of Floridians on food stamps, like a home, like a couple of vehicles below $8,500 in value, like a work truck or any other piece of equipment that's used in income-producing trades, those sorts of assets are excluded from the count.
Most adult recipients have to be working or looking for work a set hours per week, depending on their physical ability and number of children. But even as overall unemployment is dropping, it's still very difficult for some recipients to get a job. Bruce Ferguson with Career Source Northeast Florida says lack of education is an issue.
When we TABE test, that test of adult basic education, we are hitting third and fourth grade reading levels. That is a long process to get that up to a point to where they can apply for jobs, to even apply for a job and be eligible.
Criminal records are a barrier too.
It was shocking to us that something as simple as a $100 bounced check at some time in your past that you didn't deal with, that's a felony in the state of Florida. It's a bigger deal than you would imagine.
Which is why White is including in his bill a pilot program for regional workforce boards to focus on people who face the greatest obstacles finding a job.
It's more bodies, it's more training, and more direct assistance to those who have the hardest time getting off food stamp and other food stamps, temporary cash assistance, other programs, and getting into work.
That part of the bill is winning over some surprising supporters, like Karen Woodall. She heads the Florida Center for Fiscal and Economic Policy, and her progressive stances mostly put her at odds with the state's Republican leadership.
Unlike last year, I'm actually here to support Representative White's legislation. I appreciate you're not including the areas that we were most concerned with last year and for incorporating the in-depth work through the workforce boards to really get to what's keeping people from getting jobs and getting placement. We think that's very important.
Unlike last year, the bill won't lower the income threshold to qualify. That could win more supporters as the measure moves forward. At its first committee hearing, Democratic Representative Barrington Russell voted for the bill. Three Democrats voted no, and another didn't vote. The bill has two more stops before the House floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Florida universities don't always have the resources to help students with mental illnesses. Addressing those matters is a serious problem faced by institutions of higher learning. They're expected to play a big role in identifying symptoms and helping individuals get better. Florida Public Radio's Victoria Weller spoke to a student who feels her school offered help during a difficult time.
I was diagnosed with depression while I was in high school. But then when I came to college, I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
That's Tamira Vandergrift, a senior at Florida State University. Her experience is not unusual for students in college. Jay Reeve, CEO of mental health facility Apalachee Center, says it's common for symptoms to begin to show during this age.
Under conditions of heightened stress or heightened anxiety, their symptoms are going to get worse. Now, it's true for folks with bipolar disorder, depression, basically every kind of mental illness.
Colleges are well aware of the growing need for mental health services, and universities are introducing new programs for students to cope with anxiety and stress. Every semester, FSU's National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI chapter, puts on an art therapy event with the goal of helping students relax. Having seen the benefits of art therapy herself, painting teacher Debbie Whitney says she has noticed remarkable change among patients with mental illnesses.
People that walk in with clenched fists and shoulders hunched leave, and their hands are open and their shoulders are back. They're possibly even like hugging people in the class, and they walk in and they're so closed, and they walk out and you feel this openness.
After her diagnosis, Vandergrift did not turn to art therapy, but instead sought support through other programs FSU offers.
I started off seeing a counselor at the FSU Counseling Center, and my counselor there was really, really helpful. She was encouraging me to go see a psychiatrist, and you know, oh God, psychiatry, that has such an awful stigma, an awful like sound to it. So finally, when I went to go see a psychiatrist, then I got like the right help I needed. And so I just got a lot better right after that, honestly.
While counseling services are available everywhere, schools do have limitations. That's something Vandergrift is familiar with.
For one thing, the counseling center for students that are going there regularly, they're limited to 12 sessions like per semester or per year, I forget which. But that's because they have so limited counselors on staff. So if they were able to hire more people, that would be really great.
A recent report from the Florida Board of Governors showed only four universities met the minimum staffing requirements, including Florida Polytechnic University with one counselor per 600 students. The International Association of Counseling Services suggests one professional to every 1,500 students. While FSU and Florida A&M University are both understaffed, with almost 2,000 students per counselor, they don't fall considerably below minimum staffing. Florida International University has the most students per counselor. Board member Norman Tripp says the state university system is committed to improving mental health services on campuses.
In 2017-18, the universities expect to hire a total of 56 new staff. A total of 105 additional mental health staff will be hired over the next 4 years.
According to the presentation by the board, FSU intends on hiring 23 new counselors over the next 4 years. FAMU will hire one additional psychologist this school year. Universities are funding new counselors on their own after lawmakers denied the request for more state funding. The Board of Governors has been asking for more money to help students with mental illnesses on campus for more than 2 years. For WFSU News, I'm Victoria Weller.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, Florida's wildlife officials say protecting the state's flora and fauna requires buy-in from more than just the traditional anglers and sportsmen. Now Reagan McCarthy reports the State Conservation Commission is working to cast a wider net.
So do me a favor, close your eyes for a second. Please, humor me. I want you to think of your first experience with wildlife. Okay, got that image in your mind?
For FWC Chairman Brian Yablonski, it's a memory with his father.
We used to go to, we were on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and we would take a little John boat, go out to Assateague Island, which you're familiar with. This is your backyard, exactly. And I remember catching my first flounder there and being amazed, you know, that I was really young and I had a flounder.
And it
was
like, wow, two eyes on one side of it.
Yablonski is talking with Colin O'Mara from the National Wildlife Foundation. O'Mara says these days many kids don't have the opportunity to build those kinds of memories.
Right, so more kids are playing video games, playing, you know, big buck hunter on, you know, I know, PlayStation 12 or whatever we're on, than actually going out and being in a deer stand, right?
O'Mara says the average kid spends about 50 hours a week indoors using some kind of device with a screen.
And that means they don't have the all experiences you all mentioned. 90% of kids in this country don't have those kind of intimate experiences in their first 5 years of wildlife. They might go hiking or something. There might be some kind of outdoor activity. But in terms of having a physical interaction with wildlife, it's much more likely to happen in their backyard with maybe a songbird or, like, you know, a monarch or something, which is incredible. But they're not having the repeat interactions because they're not playing outside.
O'Mara says that's causing wildlife conservation efforts to focus on just about a third of the animals that live in the United States. And they're the animals that people who do spend time outdoors care about, game animals and sports fish. But he says there are so many other species that need the public's attention.
Look at, like, the monarch butterfly, right? We're down 80 to 90% compared to where we were 15 years ago. You look at the bee populations in most parts of the country. Absolutely terrifying where they are, and it's affecting agriculture all across the country. I mean, I have friends in the Central Valley in California, and I'm sure as you do too, that are now paying to truck bees in because there aren't enough kind of native bee populations to serve as pollinators. If you start looking at things like freshwater mussels, 72% of freshwater mussels are actually at risk of potentially being needing listing as being endangered in the next 20 years.
Experts say one solution to get Floridians involved is to help them understand how conservation supports some of the things they might care about most, such as clean air and clean water. And Yablonski says that's a lesson he's learned throughout the length of his career.
Our job is connecting the natural world to people.
The state's Wildlife Commission is preparing for serious change in the new year as Yablonski and FWC Executive Director Nick Wiley leave their posts. And officials say they're hopeful as commissioners move through that change, they'll also embrace a change in the way they view and define conservation. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. Happy holidays, and join us again next week for a special year-end wrap-up of Capitol Report.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.